2012, January 19th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 12, Climate Regulation and Climate Change. Well, today we're going to finish off the very first section of looking at the question of life on Earth. We've been looking at the Earth as a planet. We've been looking at the processes that occur on the planet, both geologically and now today in the atmosphere. These are going to have bearing on the history of the Earth, the history of life on Earth, and giving us some of the hints as to the kinds of questions we should be asking when we try to assess what are the factors that makes a planet habitable. So that's why this has been looking a lot more like an Earth sciences class than an astronomy class this week. Next week, it's going to look even less like an astronomy class when we talk about the nature of life. In fact, it's going to seem like a high school biology class. So it's kind of a weird course that you're taking. It's astronomy, biology, earth sciences, physics, a little bit of history. And today is going to be atmospheric physics. So today we're going to talk about climate regulation and climate change. Really what we're talking about is the climate history of the Earth. What are the factors that determine what the climate is, what the mean temperature is on the planet, what form water's in, and so forth. We're going to look at the following ideas. Earth's climate has changed dramatically, very significantly, over the course of geologic history. And we can understand why it's changed and what the factors are that led to that change. There's a couple facts we're going to get across in today's lectures. The first of these is we're going to come back to this idea of the greenhouse effect that we saw the other day. The greenhouse effect is the factor of the atmosphere that helps determine what the mean temperature of the Earth is. It doesn't determine the absolute temperature point to point, but it establishes the baseline, the average, that then the local temperatures will fluctuate around. As we saw before, the greenhouse effect makes the Earth warm enough for liquid water. We're going to ask questions when we talk about other planets of what role does the greenhouse effect play in its atmosphere and determining its habitability. We're then going to introduce something which we only touched on a little bit the other day, the carbon dioxide cycle, the CO2 cycle. This is the means by which the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere is regulated by a combination of factors in the atmosphere and is driven in large measure by plate tectonics. In fact, the carbon dioxide cycle requires two factors: the presence of liquid water and plate tectonics. Together, it's not just individually, not just the greenhouse cycle and not just the CO2 cycle, but together, the CO2 cycle and the greenhouse effect act together to form like a thermostat. They together form the climate regulation system on our planet. And we'll see it, in fact, as an example, a classic example of a negative feedback loop. We'll go through that in quite a bit of detail in this class. Now, one of the things about this cycle is it's stable, but it's got some very big swings. You can force the system out of a fairly delicate equilibrium. And we've seen this multiple times in history. There have been periods where the Earth has been largely covered in ice, where there's been heavy periods of glaciation we refer to as ice ages. This appears to be correlated very strongly with cycles of variation in the Earth's orbit and the Earth's tilt. Finally, we've got to sneak a little astronomy in there. But in particular, these cycles of glaciation, the fact it was an ice age 20,000, 30,000 years ago covered most of North America and Europe with ice, is not the only time in history that's happened. And we'll look at some of the factors that have led to that, how you tip the balance of the CO2 cycle and greenhouse thermal regulation system. And finally, in recent years, looking at the geological record, scientists have determined that there have in fact been at least two episodes in the Earth's history when there have been extremely deep ice ages that covered the entire planet and Earth. And they refer to this situation as snowball Earth. It represents an extreme of which climate change cycle can be pushed in one direction or another. So we're going to look at this idea of climate regulation and climate change that's occurred through Earth's history and piece together the Earth's climate history and see what we can learn about what one of the other factors is that determines the habitability of our planet. Well, the first thing to start out with is this idea of the greenhouse effect. We saw this the other day. In fact, there's the slide we looked at the other day where we did the energy budget of radiation coming in from the sun, and that some fraction of that is radiated away or reflected away into space. But in general, 51% of the sunlight that hits the ground is absorbed in the ground and heats the ground and oceans. 19% is absorbed by and heats the atmosphere, and about 30% is reflected back into space. And this just gives the detailed budget among those. When you take into account the greenhouse effect, what happens is the radiation trying to get back out through the atmosphere, either radiated off the Earth or reflected off of clouds or sort of radiated by warm atmosphere, has to run a gauntlet through the atmosphere of molecules. So the radiation is visible light coming in, but converted into heat radiation, infrared radiation coming out by the warm Earth and oceans. Those infrared photons do not see a transparent atmosphere. They see an atmosphere which is very strongly opaque. It's opaque because of the presence of absorption from certain key molecular absorbers in the Earth's atmosphere. Principal among these is water vapor, the gaseous form of water. Carbon dioxide are the two strongest bands that absorb radiation trying to get out of the Earth's atmosphere. When they absorb that energy goes into heating the atmosphere over and above what you would get if it could just simply pass out without being absorbed. And finally, methane is the third of these gases. So we refer to these collectively as the greenhouse gases. All of these are strong infrared absorbers. They let the Earth's atmosphere act like a big blanket. And the net effect is this number here. The Earth is 35 degrees Celsius warmer than it would be without the presence of an atmosphere because of the greenhouse effect. If there was no atmosphere, the Earth would have a pretty much constant surface temperature of about minus 10 degrees Celsius. That means frozen water. But in fact, the Earth's average temperature is around 20, 25 degrees Celsius in round numbers. That's kind of room temperature, and that's liquid water for the most part. Okay, today's not going to be a liquid water day, but on average, water falling out of the sky in Columbus is liquid. So that's part one. The Earth is warmer than it would be without an atmosphere because of the greenhouse effect, this trapping of atmospheric gases. And one of the principal gases responsible for that is carbon dioxide. Now, water vapor is important, but carbon dioxide is particularly important because carbon dioxide takes part in a geological cycling that goes on called the CO2 cycle. How much carbon dioxide is present in the Earth's atmosphere is regulated by a fairly detailed cycle that works as follows. Water vapor can condense into liquid water and fall out as raindrops. However, when raindrops form in the presence of carbon dioxide gas, they can dissolve some of that carbon dioxide gas within them. Carbon dioxide dissolved into water forms a very weak acid. It's called carbolic acid. That means it's capable of etching rock. So we end up with rain being naturally mildly acidic. Now, you can also make rain a little extra acidic because volcanoes, for example, belch out sulfates, hydrogen sulfide. And so, in fact, water can also trap those sulfates as a second-order effect, and that makes sulfuric acid. So raindrops are always naturally a little acidic, primarily due to carbolic acid plus a little bit of sulfuric acid from the sulfates from volcanoes. When the rain hits rock, it doesn't just simply splatter on the rock. Those acids react with the rock and actually sort of erode them a bit. So you get physical erosion from the flow of water across rock, plus a little bit of acid action that kind of gives you a little extra something to really eat into the rock. This washes the rock, which is now rich in carbon dioxide-rich sediments, down into the ocean. So it rains on the mountains, washes down these carbon dioxide-rich sediments, and they generally collect in the ocean basins of the Earth. The carbon dioxide is in two forms. It's dissolved into the water, and it also is in carbon dioxide-rich rock being worn off the surface of the Earth through weathering into the oceans. Now, this dissolved CO2, when it gets into the ocean water, can react chemically with calcium, primarily, to make a mineral called calcium carbonate. Calcium carbonate is the principal chemical inside of limestone. Calcium carbonate is heavier than water, and it precipitates out. It falls to the bottom of the ocean basins and collects as a sediment. So the carbon dioxide goes from gas to a dissolved in liquid to actually forming a mineral carbonate, which then precipitates out and collects as a sediment at the ocean bottoms. As more of this sediment and other junk collects and piles up on the ocean bottoms, it gets compressed. It goes from a sedimentary rock to a metamorphic rock, and it becomes part of the Earth's crust. In fact, it becomes part of the ocean plates, are very, very rich in carbonates. Now, we know that the Earth's plates are not static. There are 16 tectonic plates that grind against each other, and some of these, especially the thinner ocean plates, often subduct underneath the thicker continental plates. As those plates subduct underneath the continental plate, they're compressed and heated, and eventually driven down to the lowest layer where the rock melts. but the rock is melting with the pressure of all the rock of the crust above it. And so you end up with the gases being dissolved into. The carbon dioxide gets turned back into a dissolved gas. But now it's not dissolved in water. It's dissolved in molten rock. And so if you were to dig down deep in the earth and find the molten rock just below the crust, it'd be just like soda pop. It'd be loaded with dissolved carbon dioxide and also a little bit of dissolved water vapor and sulfates and other stuff. Now, every now and then, this carbon dioxide-rich dissolved gas molten rock finds its way back to the surface in a volcano, pops the top off the geological pop bottle, and poof, gaseous carbon dioxide is returned back into the atmosphere, closing the loop. So it's a complex cycle whereby plate tectonics and volcanism returns carbon dioxide that has been converted into carbonates back into gas form, water vapor, and this is, again, the key role is water here. Water, rain out of the atmosphere, carries gaseous carbon dioxide back into the oceans. Second major role for water, a place to carry dissolved carbon dioxide. Dissolving carbon dioxide in water makes it available for chemical sedimentation through carbonates, and then the cycle repeats over and over again. So this cycle of carbon cycle, carbon dioxide cycle, depends upon a combination of plate tectonics and liquid water. If you don't have liquid water on your planet, you don't have a way to, if you will, scrub gaseous carbon dioxide out of your atmosphere. So you wouldn't have a carbon dioxide cycle. You could have a carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere like Venus, but Venus is too hot for liquid water. In fact, Venus, it will turn out, has no liquid water. So the carbon dioxide stays in Venus's atmosphere. Similarly, if you didn't have plate tectonics, even if you had liquid water, if you say you had liquid water but you had only one big tectonic plate and that was it, then you would precipitate out water in your oceans, you would make it into calcium carbonate, it would settle down as a sediment to the ocean floors, and then it would be permanently part of the crust. Without plate tectonics, there's no way to recycle that crust from solid rock to molten rock back through volcanism to close the loop to return carbon dioxide in gas form. So liquid water dissolves oceanic CO2, plate tectonics with subduction drags those carbonate rocks down below where they're melted, releasing the CO2 but trapping it in the molten rock, and then only when it breaks through the surface through volcanoes is it returned back into the gas phase in the atmosphere. So two factors are important in the carbon dioxide cycle: the presence of liquid water and plate tectonics. Have no plate tectonics or no liquid water, you shut down the cycle. Okay, keep that one in mind. Now, so we've got the greenhouse effect on one hand that uses carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as one of the principal gases to make the Earth's atmosphere a blanket to make it warmer. And we've got the carbon dioxide cycle, which regulates how much carbon dioxide is in the atmosphere at a given time. We put those two together and they actually form a very nice classical negative feedback loop that combined, the CO2 cycle and the greenhouse effect, actually acts like a thermostat. Now remember how a thermostat works. You've got, there's usually a thermostat somewhere in this room, right over here. This one doesn't work where the dam, because this room is always too warm. But basically how it would work, if it actually worked, is it has a temperature sensor in there. And you have a set point. And you say if the temperature goes above a certain temperature, the room is too warm, start pushing cold air out of that vent to lower the temperature. It keeps pushing low cold air until the temperature drops below the bottom set point and it says, no, too cold, turn off the cold air and let the temperature naturally rise. So every time you have a change, an increase positive, you make a negative change to compensate, and eventually what happens is it comes into equilibrium. What happens in this room is you put 90 people and one person here talking like mad, a bright projector light pumping out heat, and basically, you've got enough sources of heat that the poor air conditioner isn't working very well. It says equilibrium at a fairly high temperature, and so it's uncomfortably warm in here. Empty this room out. When I came in here the first time during vacation to see what the room was like, there was no one in here. Nothing was turned on. The set point was exactly the same, but the equilibrium was at a lower temperature because there weren't a lot of heat sources to compensate for. So thermostats work pretty good, but they have a range of operation. So too is going to be the case with the CO2 thermostat. This combination of the carbon dioxide cycle and the greenhouse effect are going to work together. Now this is a picture coming out of your book, and I'm going to break this now into the two halves. of this to show you how the thermostat for the atmosphere works. Let's look at this side. Let's say we take the global temperature and we let the global temperature suddenly drop by a certain amount. If we drop by a certain amount, it turns out that the cooler temperatures means that you have less rainfall. You might get snow, but snow is not very good at dissolving carbon dioxide. So you get less rainfall when it gets cold. It's colder and drier. So you leave more carbon dioxide behind in the Earth's atmosphere. There's less of it being scrubbed out by raindrops, and therefore it's left in the atmosphere as a greenhouse gas. What this means is because at lower temperatures, you're scrubbing out less carbon dioxide. As the volcanoes belch out carbon dioxide, you'll get a net buildup because the volcanoes don't care whether it's raining or not. The volcanoes don't care if it's hot or cold or not. The volcano is a volcano. It belches carbon dioxide and water vapor into the air. So you get a net buildup of carbon dioxide. But a net buildup of carbon dioxide increases the greenhouse gases. The greenhouse gas increases, you made the blanket heavier, the temperature goes up. As the temperature warms back up, all of a sudden, it starts raining more. So the compensation of cooling the temperature, lowering the rainfall, leading to a CO2 buildup, leads to the temperature warming back up, rainfall is renewed, and the system comes back into equilibrium. It's a classical example of a negative feedback loop. You make a positive change, and the system makes a negative compensatory change in response. Let's look at the other side of that. I had the temperature going down on the Earth. What happens if I raise the global temperature? We won't ask how, we just raise the global temperature. Well, warmer temperatures means there's more rainfall. More rainfall means there's more carbon dioxide getting scrubbed out, because every raindrop carries its load of carbon dioxide. Less, more carbon dioxide means that over time you build up a net deficit of carbon dioxide. The warmer climate leads to faster scrubbing of the carbon dioxide than it's getting belched by the volcanoes. So you end up with a net deficit. You release some of the greenhouse effect. You make the greenhouse effect weaker. You've made the blanket thinner. And what happens? The global temperature will begin to drop in response. So again, it's just like a thermostat. If it gets too warm, it introduces a cooling to go it back down. If it gets too cool, it introduces a form of heating to push it back up. And so you get a negative feedback. Positive response produces a compensatory response. Positive driving produces a negative, a reverse compensating response. And so it works pretty well, but as it turns out, this is a pretty delicate balance. All I've included in this is water vapor removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and the primary form of return is volcanoes. Now, another form of carbon dioxide uptake is things like plant life on Earth, so you can make small tweaks in this. But the major source of carbon dioxide removal from the atmosphere is the presence of water. That's the primary chemical way to scrub carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So this balance is pretty delicate, just like the balance of a thermostat. We upset the balance of that thermostat by putting 90 warm bodies in here. And so the temperature of this room rises. We've pushed it out of equilibrium. We've added a forcing term. If I opened up a window, I would have cold air pouring in here, and the thermostat would be going crazy, and the global temperature of this room would drop, because I've added an external forcing term, which is upsetting the delicate balance of the poor little thermostat system. The same thing happens in atmospheres. This delicate balance can be upset in various ways by influences that act from outside the regulation cycle. Again, the thermostat is basically controlling the air coming through the vents and measuring the temperature in the room. Bringing in people or opening windows is bringing an outside influence outside of that control cycle. So is true in the atmosphere. What on Earth's atmosphere can change the outside influence? One of these things can be the amount of sunlight. That's the amount of global heating going on because we're heated by light from the sun. This is often referred to as solar forcing. What are ways that the sun forcing can happen? Well, the sun is not the same brightness now as it was in the distant past. The sun was a different brightness. So changes in the sun's brightness as the sun evolves and develops over many billions of years will change the input. Now, that's a very, very slow change that occurs on billions of years. The other thing that can change is the Earth's orbit or the Earth's tilt, how far away the Earth is from the sun, or the relationship of heating and cooling between the seasons. Do I have a big difference or a small difference? We'll see that in a second. Another somewhat dramatic external forcing event is you have an asteroid impact. The asteroid impact, big, makes a big crater, shockwave, kills a bunch of dinosaurs, or something like that. But it also has the effect of blowing a lot of dust and debris into the Earth's atmosphere. It can throw enough debris into the upper atmosphere to actually cause there to be a particulate blanket. Now you've got something outside of the carbon dioxide circle interrupting the heating and cooling balance of the planet. And in fact, people think that large asteroid events kicking up dust will lead to dramatic cooling of the atmosphere, sometimes called global winter. There was actually a concern back in the 1980s that a global nuclear war, which could cause massive forest fires and tremendous fires in major cities, in addition to killing a lot of people, could throw enough particulate gunk into the Earth's atmosphere, you could get nuclear winter. That you would alter the heating and cooling balance of the Earth, that if the nuclear war wasn't bad enough, you would plunge the planet into a years-long winter, which would cause massive famines. Whether that, in fact, was the case was an example of people trying to understand how sensitive is our climate to changes in these external forcings. And finally, a third factor that has recently become important and is, of course, all the news, is the fact that human activity is beginning to work outside of the carbon dioxide cycle because we're pumping massive amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. A factory, an automobile, are basically mini volcanoes, right? The carbon that we're burning in coal is mineralized compressed plant matter. Oil is mineralized compressed dinosaurs and plant matter. It normally would be locked in the crust, but we dig it out of the crust and we burn it. That basically is giving you an additional source of carbon dioxide. So the big question we're asking now is we can see changes in the carbon dioxide presence of the atmosphere that correlates with industrial activity on the Earth. The question is, what's the effect of acting on the carbon cycle from the outside because of human activity? That's this whole issue of global warming that's in the big discussion. We're not going to talk about that in this class so much because I'm concerned more about the larger climate history of the Earth, not this local thing. But human activity falls in this same area of working outside the cycle. We all understand that it has to have an effect. What people are arguing about is, what is that effect? And the policy question is, how do we as human beings respond to that influence? But that's a different topic for a different course. So these are the carbon dioxide cycle and the greenhouse effect regulate global climate. What can we learn about the history of the Earth's climate by looking back in the geological and fossil record that can give us some idea of what are the limits? How stable is this global regulation system? How has it behaved over geologic time? Well, this is, in fact, is the Phanerozoic. This is the period from about 600 million years, 542 million years ago to the present day. So this axis here measures millions of years ago. And on the y-axis here is plotted a measure of the global temperature that's judged from an oxygen, heavy oxygen isotope measurement. It turns out that whether you have mostly liquid water or a lot of ice will affect the amount of oxygen isotopes that you get in ocean floor sediments. And so, in fact, the oxygen isotope is a way to measure what the temperature was like in the distant past. We know something about the chemistry of heavy isotope versus light isotope oxygen uptake in this case, actually benthic animals, deep sea animals, is affected by whether the chemistry is going on in liquid water or ice, whether it's going on in warm water or cold water. And so it acts as a temperature gauge. And what we see is, from the current present time to the past, there have been cycles where the temperature has gone up quite a bit. Now, this has not been put in a temperature degrees Celsius scale, but you have cold periods followed by some relatively hot periods. In fact, if you look in the record at glaciers, you find that these colder periods were actually corresponding to periods of intense glaciation, so-called ice ages. So these long-term trends here that we see are difficult to understand. Some of these appear to be related to changes in the sun's brightness over long periods of time. And that change of brightness is actually not due to the sun itself, but due to the position of the Earth in its orbit. And also to the arrangement of the continents and oceans. It's something you kind of forget about because we always think of the Earth as looking like it does today. But if I go 500 million, 600 million years ago, the Earth's oceans were much bigger and they were in a different place. So, for example, it matters whether where your poles are, where the ice caps are, is that ocean or is it land? In the current epoch, the northern polar cap is the Arctic Ocean, but the southern polar cap is the Antarctic continent. A few hundred million years ago, there may have been oceans at both poles. That would be a very different system of forming ice caps than land. or having lots of continents to absorb sunlight is different from having oceans, which are mostly reflective. That changes the balance of how the heating and cooling works. So the geology history, the shapes of the continents, the arrangement in continents and oceans actually plays a role. And of course, they're changing constantly through these periods. So let's look at a little bit more recent times. The data get better because we actually have ice cores going on. So for example, this is the last 5.5 million years of the Earth's history, looking at again, this oxygen 18 in deep sea carbonates. And what you see is, and this is a zoom now, over the last 500,000 years, and these are taken from ice cores, in particular the green curve here, pay attention, that's Vostok, which is a very deep ice shelf in the Antarctic continent, where you can dig down literally through many millions of years of strata of ice. And you can measure the temperature. Now it's measured in degrees Celsius. And what you find is that there's a continual cycling of cold periods and warm periods, periods of deep ice ages and periods of relative warmth. And the dashed line here is kind of where we are now, okay, relative to the Vostok here. This temperature scale can drop as much as 8 degrees Celsius below zero, 8 degrees Celsius below this average. What we see is in the last sort of 100,000 years, there was roughly a repetition of periods of strong ice age glaciation every 100,000 years. But then around 100,000 years ago, something changed, and it turned into a 41,000-year cycle. So the question is, what leads to these cycles of glaciation and warmth? So we got a deep glacier period. This is the last major ice age, the one that covered North America and, you know, made northern Ohio flat as a board. That's the ice age there. This is us now, here, today, in a relatively warm period. There was a relatively warm period 100,000 years ago, and then a deep ice age about 140,000 years ago, so on and so forth. So the fact that there's a repetitious pattern, we say, where in the world do you get long-term cycles? Well, one of those places turns out to be in planetary motions. So now, before we go into that, though, let's take a look at some other factors that come into play. So now we're going to look at the last 500,000 years of global temperatures, which is the blue curve, basically taken from the ice core data in Vostok, Antarctica. You can also look at trapped gases in the ice. Ices are very good at trapping gases at that time, so it gives us a snapshot of the atmosphere's content. And what we see is, during the periods of warming, is larger amounts of carbon dioxide. The green curve is carbon dioxide content. So we see that carbon dioxide content correlates with warmer global temperatures. We're in a high carbon dioxide period. The last ice age was a carbon dioxide dip. Again, remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere for some reason, the weather gets cooler. That's one of the first factors, but then it's the sudden increase in carbon dioxide that leads to continual heating. So we're seeing this pattern of effect. Down here in the red curve, you can also look at dust, atmospheric dust, from meteors, from stuff being blown off of oceans, you know, salt crystals, sand being blown off the land, dust and particulates coming out of volcanoes. Volcanic dust is a big component of this. And that gets trapped in the ice cores too. So if you ever, you know, Bird Polar Lab, if they ever have their open house, you got to go over and check it out. It's really cool. You can see in the ice cores just the history laid out vertically in these beautiful ice cores. You can see the dust layers when there's been a major volcanic eruption. It leaves a little layer right there in the ice. Boom. A little point in time. And what we see is there do seem to be periods where you get a lot of dust, for example, at this position here and this position here, there were dips in the temperature. Like dust, a lot of dust being in the atmosphere blocks sunlight from reaching the ground, and you get lower temperatures. So it kind of all begins to hang together, but this problem of cycling doesn't make sense. Volcanoes don't know cycles. Why would volcanoes erupt on a regular 100,000-year period, lots of volcanoes? It doesn't make sense. But there is a place where you can get lots of changes, and that's in the motions of the Earth, the regular orbital motion of the Earth around the Sun. Now again, kind of a classic astronomy 101 thing is to say, yeah, the Earth orbits the Sun on an ellipse with the Sun at one focus, it takes 1 year to go around, tilt of the Earth's orbit's 23.5 degrees. Boom, hard fact. All those numbers change over very long periods of time. For example, the Earth's axis is tilted. The fact that the Earth's axis is tilted 23.5 degrees is what gives us seasons. When the northern pole is pointing towards the sun, we get summer on the northern hemisphere and winter in the southern hemisphere. We're right now in a position where the sun is coming in from this direction. The pole, north pole is pointing away from the sun. We get indirect lighting in the north. It's winter. They're getting direct lighting down in South America. It was 90 degrees in Santiago the other day in Chile. So the tilt of the Earth's orbit is what gives us these seasonal variations. If I made the tilt zero, it'd be like permanent spring all over the Earth because there'd be no variation from month to month in the amount of direct or indirect sunlight. If I make the tilt really severe, then I get huge differences between the seasons. If I made the tilt 28 degrees or 30 degrees, the winters would be so deep we'd be nose deep in snow in October and boiling up in July. We'd have like a one-month winter, one-month summer, where it's really intense. So the greater the tilt, the more intense the seasonal variations. So this gives us a cycle. It turns out that tilt is not permanent, but it's wobbling a little bit. And we can measure the amount of that wobble astronomically, and we find that it takes about 41,000 years to go between the extremes and back. So I go from the lowest tilt in about 20,000 years down to the highest tilt, and another 20,000 years back, repeating the cycle. And so it kind of wobbles back and forth. Less tilt, milder seasonal variations, means your winters are milder, less snow. More tilt, bigger seasonal variations, you get more intense snowfall. More intense snowfall means ice cover. Ice is highly reflective, bounces sunlight out. That's less sunlight available to heat the atmosphere. So it leads to very large variations in global temperature. That's just one of the cycles. There's a couple others that come into play. And a number of years ago, a fellow by the name of Milankovitch noticed that some of these cycles can actually work. They work at different scales. The changes in the Earth's axis tilt, is one we just talked about, is every 41,000 years. The Earth's orbit is elliptical, so the Earth comes closer and further from the Sun on a regular basis. But that actually has three cycles built in. Ooh, make it complicated. 95, 125, and 413,000 years. So sometimes we're fairly elliptical and we come really relatively close to the Sun. You're warmer because you're closer to the Sun. And then you move a little bit further away. You're cooler. Right now we're in one of those cycles where the variation is not that much. And so you don't see a strong seasonal variation due to the 5 million kilometers of difference between closest to the Sun, which by the way happens in January, and furthest from the Sun, which happens in July. We don't notice it that much warmer. But there are times when those cycles reinforce and it makes a big difference. Furthermore, the precession of the Earth's orbit, which way the Earth is, or the orbit, Earth's tilt, which way it's pointing in the sky, precesses around every 26,000 years. Now normally if you had a bunch of things kind of cycling and bouncing around, you would never expect them to work very much together. They kind of mostly, you know, one would be going up, making the Earth warmer, while the other one's making the Earth cooler, they cancel out. But what happens if they all decide to work together to make the Earth warmer or work together to make the Earth cooler? Then you get very, very large swings in the amount of solar radiation. And it's these large swings that form what are called the Milankovitch cycles. So here's the precession period. Here's the obliquity. This is, again, this last 1 million years. Precession going every 26,000 years. The obliquity, the tilt of the orbit, actually there's a tilt there. So obliquity is a tilt of the axis, is every 41,000 years. The eccentricity is this wacky triple cycle of 95, 125, and 400,000 years. So you get this variation. And then there's various information about what the Sun is doing. Well, this is now the combined effect of all these cycles gives you this change in the solar forcing, the amount of direct versus indirect sunlight at a fairly high latitude, 65 degrees north, which is getting up towards the Arctic Circle, where most of the ice is on the Earth. Okay? And so you get either a lot of sunlight, and it's very warm, or you get only a little bit of sunlight, and it gets fairly cool. And you can get periods where not much is going on, and there are huge swings. And if you combine those together, these biggest swings roughly correspond to the known periods of glaciation on the Earth. So when you get these very large swings in temperature, especially to low temperatures, you start building a lot of ice in the north. But as you build up ice, the Earth becomes more reflective. As it becomes more reflective, it absorbs less sunlight and becomes cooler. As it becomes cooler, it leads to more snow in winter, which leads to the formation of more ice, which is more reflectivity. And it's a mild positive feedback. You make a change, and it literally snowballs. And you lead to this period of runaway glaciation. But eventually, the cycle catches up with you when you suddenly get a lot more sunlight because you're on the big side of the solar forcing. You melt a lot of the water. You have milder winters. You have less snow. Less snow means warmer summers, which means less winter. And guess what? You start having the glaciers retreat. This takes many thousands of years, but we see these cycles of glaciation. It's not perfect. It doesn't explain everything. It's pretty clear there are other factors going on, but solar forcing is a big deal. Now, what's interesting, though, is you get these times when the Earth is warm, the Earth is cool, but what happens if you really reach out and really tip it further out? It's like one of those little, you know, wobble dolls, you know, the little wobble punch bags play with when we were kids. You know, you bounces back and forth, and the little weight in the back brings it into stability. But what happens if you really lay that sucker over? Can you lay it over so when it falls over, it never comes back? Or does it come back real slow? How stable? What's the center of gravity, if you will? How stable is the Earth's climate system? How hard can you push it, in other words? Well, it turns out you could push it pretty darn hard. In the distant past, very recently, in the last 20 years or so, we've identified two periods in the Earth's history. One of them occurred during the late Proterozoic eon, between 750 and 580 million years ago, just before the major emergence of life. Major emergence of animal life, I mean. And the early Proterozoic, between 2.4 and 2.2 billion years ago. What we find is evidence that the Earth was extremely cold. The ocean sediments and ocean fossils that have been looked at, which basically look at uptake of oxygen from water, and how much oxygen gets into water of 18 oxygen versus 16 oxygen depends on temperature. What we find is the measurement shows a global average temperature of 50 degrees Celsius below zero. That's as cold, that makes even Minnesotans think it's pretty damn cold outside. Not to mention Alaskans. When you get the global temperature, minus 50 degrees Celsius, global temperature, for that long, the oceans would have been frozen to a depth of 1 kilometer. So imagine the thinner portions of the Antarctic ice sheet, where you get 1,000 meters of ice covering the global oceans. Now, what happens if you cover the oceans with ice? If you lock up the liquid water, what happens? There's nowhere for the carbon dioxide to dissolve into the water. Access to the deep ocean is blocked by the ice layer. You shut down the carbon dioxide cycle. So this is pushing the system so far to the extreme that the carbon dioxide cycle says, to hell with it, and it quits. It stops. And we get an extreme cold period, which is referred to as snowball Earth. Now, it was thought this was how do you get this to happen? And if it happened, why is it the punchy clown didn't fall over? Why did the Earth ever thaw back out again? And the answer turns out to be because one part of the carbon dioxide cycle shut down. Remember, the carbon dioxide cycle requires two things, liquid water and plate tectonics. Freezing the Earth's ocean shuts down the water, but it doesn't shut down the plate tectonics. What does that mean? Well, what happens here? What we think happens, where this happened, was that when you have very large polar oceans and a particular cold glaciation period led to very large ice caps, but it happened over the oceans, so you immediately had your polar caps for the period of glaciation starts blocking off the oceans, which starts shutting down the amount of carbon dioxide uptake in the atmosphere. They grow very quickly, so quickly that you get an extended cold smell and the oceans start to freeze. Once the oceans freeze, carbon dioxide shut down. The reflectivity of the Earth goes way up, and so sunlight just bounces off the ice, and the Earth gets even colder still. We've been pushed into a weak positive feedback regime. But plate tectonics is still going on. Volcanoes are still erupting up through the ice. What does a volcanic eruption do? It belches carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide builds up in the atmosphere. Normally, carbon dioxide would be rained out into the oceans, but there's no ocean to rain into. It's underneath a kilometer of ice. So the carbon dioxide builds and builds and builds. It builds up until it's 1,000 times the current carbon dioxide content of our atmosphere. You get a very strong greenhouse effect, and the Earth begins to warm dramatically. What does that do? It melts the oceans. You melt the oceans. What happens? Boom! The carbon dioxide cycle kicks into play, and all that excess carbon dioxide, it's super warm, lots of steam, steamy weather, high humidity means lots of rain. and the carbon dioxide begins raining out dramatically, and you begin to reestablish and reset the thermostat. So what Snowball Earth is like doing is you get an episode where your roommate opens up all the windows and forgets about it, and a cold front comes through and just absolutely overwhelms your furnace. And then finally, you get the idea to close the windows again, and you shut down the external forcing. So what happens in Snowball Earth is you shut down the CO2 cycle when you lock up the oceans, but the fact that volcanism is still going on ultimately builds up a big greenhouse effect that melts the ice and reestablishes the cycle. You just need a lot of time for the buildup. So Snowball Earth is an example of how far you can push the system. But as long as I've got plate tectonics and water, which are independent systems, there's a chance for that system to hopefully get back into equilibrium by finding a pathway out of this extreme disequilibrium. Now, of course, you could, in fact, push it too far one way or another. One of the ways you can push it is push it to an extreme position where, let's say, you build up the Earth too warm, put a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and it heats up, but it starts heating up to the point that the water vapor spends more of its time in the atmosphere than raining out. At some point, rain doesn't form if it gets too hot in the atmosphere. What happens? The water vapor stays as water vapor, works its way to the top of the atmosphere. When water vapor is hit by ultraviolet radiation, it breaks into oxygen and hydrogen. The oxygen quickly oxidizes anything nearby, and the hydrogen is light, and it's hot, and it escapes. So your water is destroyed. And if you do that long enough, you will actually dry out your atmosphere. Now all of a sudden you have an atmosphere with no water and all carbon dioxide. Can't happen? Happened on the planet Venus. That's why Venus's surface temperature is 800 degrees Celsius. It's got a massive 1,000 more times bigger carbon dioxide atmosphere than the Earth. Its carbon dioxide cycle was shut down by completely removing liquid water from the planet. So this is going to be one of the things that we're going to look at when we start considering what is it makes a planet habitable. Liquid water turns out to be really important because it's liquid water that seems to be a requirement for a stable biosphere, for a well-regulated atmosphere that doesn't run away to one extreme, snowball, or the other extreme, oven. Is there an example of a snowball planet in a solar system? Mars is going to be an example of a snowball planet, but a different example. Mars is going to be an example where it was so cold it never recovered from a freezing period. Mars may have had liquid water in its past, but it went through a cold period and it was so far out of equilibrium it never recovered because Mars is small. It's not as geologically active. It didn't have a large carbon dioxide source in volcanism. When the interior cooled and the volcanism shut off, it had nowhere to go but stay cold. So we see in our solar system, make the atmosphere so hot that water vapor goes away, Venus. Make the planet so cold and it's so small geologically that it shuts down its carbon cycle and the other way it freezes, snowball Mars. Even though it's covered with snow, there's probably a huge amount of water ice buried beneath the surface. Bring those two into balance, look around you, it's the Earth. So this is one of the major lessons from Earth's global history, and we can now carry this to the other planets. And I got a little ahead of myself there. The Earth has experienced tremendous cycles of climate change over its long history. We see the presence of negative and positive feedback cycles at work. How stable those are, we don't really know. We have some idea, but this is what gets people worried about global warming. Could we do something that pushes the cycle somewhere where maybe it doesn't make the Earth into Venus, but it makes it uninhabitable for humans? That's the question. It's the other thing that comes into play, an important point, is it's not just the atmosphere. It's the atmosphere and the geography and the presence of liquid water, the composition of the planet, is what helps decide whether it's got a stable biosphere and liquid water or not. That determines part of the habitability of the Earth. So this is going to have a lot of implications for us. And another thing it's going to have a look at is now look at the history of life on Earth and how did the interplay between climate and geology influence what life was on Earth. But to really get at that question, I have to ask a more basic question. What is life? How do we define life and how does it respond to its environment? And that's what we'll start in on Monday. Any questions? Okay. I will see you all tomorrow for quiz number 1.